Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for our webinar. Today, we're going to be talking about common aerospace pitfalls, and we're going to be reviewing some requirements that are commonly misunderstood by clients. My name is Amanda Brown, and I am the Aerospace Programs and Accreditation Manager for Perry Johnson Registrars. I'm also an aerospace auditor, and I've been with the company for about 13 years now. Kim Wagner will be joining us through the presentation. She is a member of our executive committee. She's an aerospace auditor, and she has also been with the company for about 6 years. Just an overview of some things we're going to be covering. The first one that we're going to go over is our value-added process measures. The second one is organizational risk requirements versus operational risk requirements. And then the last is the control of non-conforming products process requirements and corrective action process requirements. Just a couple of things to let you know. The webinar slides will be on our PJR website available for you. And the webinar recording will be on our PJR YouTube channel. There should be a link to our YouTube channel on our PJR website. Otherwise, you can just go to YouTube and search for PJR.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Kim Wagner. As Amanda said, the first topic we're going to be looking at is value-added process measures. So to start, I thought we'd look at the specific requirement for this in AS 9100. And this is found in 441, specifically in subclauses C and G. So it says here, the organization shall determine the processes needed for the quality management system and their application throughout the organization, and shall, C, determine and apply the criteria and methods, including monitoring, measurements, and related performance indicators needed to ensure the effective operation and control of these processes. Then in G, shall evaluate these processes and implement any changes needed to ensure that these processes achieve their intended results. So what is the actual intent of these subclauses? How are you supposed to implement this requirement? How many process measures do you need? And are these the same as your quality objectives? We're going to get into all of that. So we have here a question from a clarification document that the IAQG has put together, and the IAQG is the International Aerospace Quality Group. They put together a bunch of frequently asked questions they have on the standards. And so we're going to focus on one that specifically asks about 441 C and G. So the question asks, is the intent of the standard that an organization can have just a top level requirement that is used to evaluate the effectiveness of the QMS in several individual processes without those processes having specific metrics? So their example here is they're using on-time delivery of the product to the customer as a top-level metric, but also as the metric that is used to evaluate the purchasing process, the contract review process, and the manufacturing process with no additional metrics. So if they have met their on-time delivery goal, then all processes are deemed as effective. And the answer from IAQG is no, this is not the intent of 441 C and G. They go on to say that the 9100 series standards require the organization to determine if the identified processes are effective in achieving planned results. Each process measure should evaluate the effectiveness of that process and be value added. So if you're familiar with the forms that are used in aerospace, these measures are what would be included on the process effectiveness assessment report, or the PEAR forms, as we call them. They do say also that the 9100 series standard does not mandate a certain number of process measures, but those process measures need to be specific to those processes and be value added. They also note here that it is typical for smaller organizations to have fewer measures than larger organizations, and this is because these smaller organizations have a higher level of visibility regarding their process health due to their size. But regardless, This does not alleviate the need for determining if processes are effective in achieving planned results. They also say that the organization can have additional working measures that may not flow up to top management or management review. So what does this mean for your quality management system? In the example that we saw, the client was using a single top-level objective, which was on-time delivery, to measure all processes, including their contract review process, their purchasing process, and their manufacturing process. And as the answer indicates, using a top-level objective as an overall measure for all processes is not appropriate and does not meet the intent of 441. So you may have your quality objectives and you may be measuring those, but you need to go a little bit further when it comes to process-specific measurements. As they said, each process measure should evaluate the effectiveness of that process and be value added. So what are some examples of some measures that are more value added and provide a more precise measure of effectiveness of these processes? Where you can find some good examples of some really value added key performance indicators is in the Supply Chain Management Handbook. Now, this is an IAQG online resource that was developed by subject matter experts to assist organizations with understanding requirements and how to apply them. It's a great resource to have on hand. I believe it's free to access. You just need to create a user ID and password in order to access it. And specifically within section 7.11.2, it includes some really great examples of value-added key performance indicators that you can apply to your processes. So it'll help you go a step further, more so than just having your quality objectives, and it leads you to have some more specific process measures for your operational processes. So we've put together a few examples that we took from the Supply Chain Management Handbook for some of the processes that were included in that original question in that FAQ. So for the contract review process, for example, in the example we looked at, the client was just using on-time delivery to measure the whole contract review process. And instead here, we've got five examples of some key performance indicators that go a step further and are really focused on the activities within the contract review process. So for example, you could use quote turnaround time as a measurement, which would measure how many requests for quotes are answered with quotes sent to customer within a defined time frame, for example, 3 days for the total number of answered RFQs. So this would help you measure the efficiency and the effectiveness of answering the quoting team answering RFQs, how fast those are being turned around. Another example is order entry errors, which would measure how many orders are entered with errors versus how many total orders entered within a given time frame. So how effective is the order entry team in translating those requirements found during contract review and entering those accurately into your system? Then we have quarterly sales, which would measure the overall sales made in a quarter versus a defined sales goal for that quarter, sales conversion rate, the number of contracts awarded versus total number of contracts bid, and adherence to program gates, which would measure the number of program milestones successfully passed on time. So these are all really zeroed in on the contract review activities. And having KPIs like this and this level would give you a higher visibility on the health of this contract review process. Okay, and then we have the purchasing process up next. Again, these are some examples of some KPIs that are really focused on the activities that go on within the purchasing process. So the first example we have here is the purchase order launch performance, which would measure the number of purchase orders sent on time versus no total number of purchase orders. Similarly, we've got purchase order acknowledgement rate, which would measure the purchase orders acknowledged by the supplier within a required due date versus total number of purchase orders sent. So these two are really focused on getting those purchase orders out on time and getting them acknowledged by suppliers. How effective is your process in doing those activities? Then we have supply chain performance, the measure of overall on quality and on time performance of the supply base. You know, how well is your supply base performing? Supplier capacity rating, the measure of the supplier's capacity versus the capacity required by the product slash program fulfillment as planned by the customer, and then receiving inspection acceptance rate, the total number of materials or services that pass receiving inspection versus the total number of received materials and services. So these are, again, more zeroed in on the purchasing process, more so than just an overall top level objective. And then finally, we have the manufacturing process and some KPI examples for this process. Scrap rate, the number of items that were scrapped divided by total number of items produced during a time period. Item escape rate from internal processes to internal customers. The number of items produced and identified as non-compliant versus total number of items produced. First pass yield, rate of on-quality deliverables produced by a process divided by the total number of deliverables going into that process, inventory accuracy, taking an actual count of items compared to what's recorded in your database, labor efficiency, the ratio between the amount of time planned for completing activities versus the actual time taken, and then on-time manufacturing, the number of items completed on time in the given time period versus number of items planned to be completed in that time period. So in summary, establishing strong value-added process measures will allow you to have a higher level of visibility on the health of your processes. If you do miss a KPI target, you can really focus in on the specific cause of the underperformance and take corrective action. This then leads you to continual improvement of each process and in turn of your overall QMS. So at this point, if you do have any questions related to this portion, you can type them into the questions area and we can read those through.
Additionally, at the end of the webinar, we'll go ahead through the questions. So if you come up with something throughout the rest of the webinar, please feel free to just go ahead and put it in the questions and we'll try to get to them at the end.
Okay, and I'm not seeing any questions now. So if you do think of anything, as Amanda said, we can get to those at the end of the presentation.
Okay, so the next topic we're going to talk about is organizational risk versus operational risk. There's two specific clauses in the standard that discuss this. It's 6.1 and 8.1.1. These clauses require your organization to manage different kinds of risks, the organizational risks versus the operational risks. Let's take a closer look at them and we'll go through some examples. So 6.1 requirement states that when planning for the quality management system, the organization shall consider the issues referred to in 4.1 and the requirements referred to in 4.2 and determine the risks and opportunities that need to be addressed to A, give assurance that the quality management system can achieve its intended results, B, enhance desirable effects, C, prevent or reduce undesired effects, or D, achieve improvement. 6.1.2 states that the organization shall A, have actions to address these risks and opportunities, B, how to integrate and implement the actions into its quality management system processes, 2, evaluate the effectiveness of these actions. Actions taken to address risks and opportunities shall be proportionate to the potential impact on the conformity of products and services. So these clauses are stating that you as an organization need to decide what the impact of these risks will be to your organization, and then you decide what kind of action needs to be taken for it. There's a couple of notes for this also. One, options to address risks can include avoiding risk, taking risk in order to pursue an opportunity, eliminating the risk source, changing the likelihood or consequences, sharing the risk, or retaining risk by informed decision. So those are all possible options that you can take. Note 2 states opportunities can lead to the adoption of new practices, launching new products, opening new markets, addressing new customers, building partnerships, using new technology and other desirable and variable possibilities to address the organization's or its customers' needs. TC-176 interpretation states the intent of this subclause is to ensure that when planning the quality management system processes, the organization determines its risks and opportunities and plans actions to address them. Its purpose is to prevent nonconformities, including nonconforming outputs, and to determine opportunities that might enhance customer satisfaction or achieve an organization's quality objectives. So for this clause, we're looking for risks that could cause harm or potential harm to the organization itself rather than the product. When determining the risks and opportunities for the quality management system, the external and internal issues, as well as relative interested party requirements, should be considered. So when you're going through 4.1 and 4.2, those items need to be considered in this risks and opportunities. Example risks that our quality management system will not achieve its objectives include the failure of processes, products, and services to meet their requirements, or the organization not achieving customer satisfaction. And customer satisfaction is the main goal of the entire standard, correct? So examples of some opportunities include the potential to identify new customers, to determine the need for new products or services, and to bring them to market, or to determine the need for revising or replacing a process by the introduction of new technology. So sometimes you may get a quote for something that comes in, a possible opportunity for your organization. And you have to decide if you don't have the equipment or technology to take that opportunity on, is it something that you want to risk going into? Do you want to put the time and the effort and the money into getting that equipment or getting that technology in order to bring on that new opportunity? So these are the risks as an organization that you need to face. When examining its opportunities, the organization should first determine and assess the potential risks to the quality management system associated with them. The results should be used when making the decisions on whether or not to implement them. So here's a couple of scenarios that would fit into the 6.1 category, the organizational risk. Number one, opportunity to improve production through investing in more capable equipment. An action plan is to purchase new equipment. So that's something that we just talked, that I had just talked about, just mentioned. Do you want to take that on? Do you want to purchase that new equipment to possibly get that new opportunity for your organization? Number two, production activities need to be reevaluated to determine the capacity of personnel needed for future jobs. So that's very important. As your organization grows, you need to reevaluate that and see how many personnel are needed. Do you need to hire more employees? Do you need to have that base grow so that you can fill the jobs that you have? Number three, increase frequency of management meetings for better project management and performance improvements. So increasing those types of meetings, increasing the communication, it can only help your organization be able to address any risks that may appear. Number four, taking into consideration the issues concerning interested parties when determining risks. Interested parties could be a government entity that you have, and you may have ITAR restrictions. So those are something that you need to address, any kind of regulatory rules that you must follow. Number five, risk analysis completed on creating new advertisements to attract new customers. So that's always something that you want to consider as an organization. What kind of advertisement do you do? Maybe it's not a new advertisement, but a new medium for the advertisement. Maybe you went from radio and now you're going to television or to ads on Facebook or any of those types of things. 8.1.1 requirement is different. It is the operational risk management. The organization shall plan, implement, and control a process for managing operational risks to the achievement of applicable requirements, which includes, as appropriate to the organization and the products and services, A, assignment of responsibilities for operational risk management, B, definition of risk assessment criteria such as likelihood, consequences, risk acceptance. C, identification, assessment, and communication of risks throughout the operations. D, identification, implementation, and management of actions to mitigate risks that exceed the defined risk acceptance criteria. And E, acceptance of risks remaining after implementation of mitigating action. Again, a couple of notes. Number one, while Clause 6.1 addresses the risks and opportunities when planning the quality management system of the organization, the scope of this clause, 8.1.1, is limited to the risks associated to operational processes needed for the provision of products and services, or the Section 8 clauses. Note number two, within the aviation space and defense industry, risk is generally expressed in terms of the likelihood of occurrence and the severity of the consequences. So this clause pertains to those items that are impacted by Clause 8 of the standards. A few scenarios for this one could be the contract fails to identify special requirements and product requirements are not properly identified. If those types of things are not properly identified, the product could turn out inadequate for your customer. The quality could be poor. So that's very important to the operational risk. Number two, internal audit discovers purchasing had been approving bad suppliers with late delivery, counterfeit parts, and overpayment. Now, this one could possibly pertain to the other, but when you're talking about counterfeit parts, that is most definitely going to fit into the 8.1.1 because it's absolutely going to affect the Clause 8, your product that you put out, your quality. Number three, an RFQ is received from the customer, and if risk is found to be within acceptable parameters, the project is accepted. The customer is notified and the sales order is created. So this is during your contract review process. You get an RFQ in and you have to see, do you want to accept the risk that if there's too much, if you don't have the on-time delivery that they may be requesting or requiring, you may not be able to meet that. Do you have a backlog of jobs already that could affect these things? So those are things that you need to review during the RFQ, during the contract review process. Number four, the utilization of FEMA to address risk and opportunities for manufacturing process. Absolutely, FEMA is a great way to go to address any of those things throughout the entirety of the process. So in summary, as we've shown, the standard does go between the risks associated with planning for your QMS, 6.1, and risks specifically associated with provision of the products and services, 8.1.1. Having effective methods in place to identify and mitigate both types of risks will allow your system to reduce undesired effects and better achieve its intended results. So if you have any questions, please feel free to put them into the questions box. And again, if you think of anything as we're going through the presentation, please feel free to go ahead and put it in your questions box and we can answer it at the end. Okay, we'll move on.
All right, so next up we have the control of non-conforming outputs and corrective action. And the reason we wanted to include this is because we've seen before these two processes kind of get lumped together, and although they are related, they do serve different functions within your QMS. And these are also the only two processes that require procedures or other means of documented information. So if you remember, the previous versions of the standard required quite a few more procedures. Now there are just these only two procedural requirements. And that's in 8.7 for the control of nonconforming outputs process and 10.2 for the nonconformity and corrective action process. So as I mentioned, these do go hand in hand, and it is acceptable to include requirements for both in a single procedure or document. However, you must be careful to ensure that your procedure addresses all aspects of both 8.7 and 10.2. So let's take a closer look at these clauses and what they require. So the intent of 8.7 is to prevent the unintended delivery or use of non-conforming outputs. And this is at all stages of production and service provision, and even after delivery as well. So there are different ways to deal with non-conforming outputs, as we'll see. And then when further action is needed after you've dealt with that non-conforming output, then the requirements for corrective action should be applied, which is when Clause 10.2 steps in. So first, I thought we'd take a look at the actual requirements in the standard, then we'll zero in on the documentation requirements. You know, what's required in that procedure, what's required in your records. We'll look at some more common misconceptions and some FAQs, and then we'll look at examples of how these processes work in action. So here's the clause in the standard itself, in 8.7. It says, the organization shall ensure that outputs that do not conform to requirements are identified and controlled to prevent their unintended use or delivery. And it clarifies in the note here that the term non-conforming outputs includes non-conforming product or service generated internally, received from an external provider, or identified by a customer. So not only are we talking about product, we're talking about non-conforming services. And so the organization shall take appropriate action based on the nature of the nonconformity and its effect on the conformity of products and services. This shall also apply to nonconforming products and services detected after delivery of products during or after the provision of services. And in blue here is where we have that requirement for the procedure as mentioned. It says here that the organization's nonconformity control process shall be maintained as documented information, including the provisions for defining the responsibility and authority for the review and disposition of nonconforming outputs and the process for approving persons making these decisions. So in that within that procedure, you have to define who can actually who is responsible for the non-conforming outputs and who can make a decision on what you're going to do with them, how you're going to disposition those non-conforming outputs. And you also have to describe the process for approving a person that can make those decisions. It also must include provisions for taking actions necessary to contain the effect of the nonconformity on other processes, products, or services. So once you do find a nonconforming output, what do you do with it? How do you contain it? How do you correct it? The procedures should describe those actions. It also needs to include provisions for timely reporting of nonconformities affecting delivered products and services to the customer and to relevant interested parties. So if you do have a nonconforming output, who do you need to let know about it? Do you need to let your customer know? Do you need to let other interested parties know? That needs to be within that procedure. And finally, it needs to have provisions for defining corrective actions for non-conforming products and services detected after delivery as appropriate to their impacts. And it points to 10.2, which is our corrective action process for this. It does also include a note here that interested parties requiring notification of non-conforming products and services can include external providers, internal organizations, customers, distributors, and regulatory authorities. So depending on your requirements. Okay, and it continues that the organization shall deal with non-conforming outputs in one or more of the following ways: correction, B, segregation, containment, return, or suspension of provision of products and services, C, informing the customer, and D, obtaining authorization for acceptance under concession by a relevant authority and when applicable by the customer. So these are sort of your options for handling non-conforming outputs. It does go on to say that dispositions of use as is or repair for the acceptance of non-conforming products shall only be implemented after approval by an authorized representative of the organization responsible for design or by persons having delegated authority from the design organization, and after authorization by the customer if the non-conformity results in a departure from the contract requirements. So you have to be careful if dispositioning as use as is or repair. It's important to have these authorizations if you're going to do so. It does also say that product disposition for scrap shall be conspicuously and permanently marked or positively controlled until physically rendered unusable. And we will return to this with another FAQ because there's a really important question related to this specific requirement. So we'll get back to that. And it also says counterfeit or suspect counterfeit parts shall be controlled to prevent reentry into the supply chain. And finally, conformity to requirements shall be verified when non-conforming outputs are corrected. So if you do have a non-conforming output and you correct it, you have to make sure that you re-verify that is conforming to requirements now. So re-inspection there. And then in 8.7.2, we have the requirements for records of the non-conforming output process. As it says, the organization shall retain documented information that A, describes the nonconformity, B, describes the actions taken, C, describes any concessions obtained, and D, identifies the authority deciding the action in respect of the nonconformity. Okay, so focusing more on the documentation that's required for the control of nonconforming outputs process. As discussed, there needs to be a procedure or other means of documented information that defines your provisions for all those items that we went over. So everything in blue here is something that needs to be captured in your procedure. You need to describe your process for all these items here. And also, in addition to this procedure, the records are necessary for the control of nonconforming outputs process. The record should describe the nonconforming output itself, the actions taken to address them, any concessions obtained from customers or other relevant authorities, and then who authorized the action to be taken. All of this should be captured in your record for the nonconforming output. Okay, so as mentioned, there was one clarification we wanted to include here from the IAQG. This was another one of those frequently asked questions that was submitted to them. And this is related to scrap and how this is handled in relation to the control of nonconforming outputs requirements. So the question asks, our organization makes parts from foam, plastics, and fiberglass, and as such, it is impossible to permanently mark the scrap. Scrap is normally the excess material from die cutting, water jet cutting, or routing. We had special bins made that had scrap / trash on the sides. These bins are emptied into a trash compactor as they fill up. Is putting this type of material in a marked bin adequate, or does each piece require marking? And so then the IAQG answered with, the intent of this requirement is to ensure no defective product re-enters the value stream, which is the purpose of having the requirement to physically render non-conforming product unusable. It is important to remember that Clause 8.7 is for product that does not conform to product requirements. Therefore, if the materials are conforming and there is material excess from die cutting, water jet cutting, or routing operations, your excess material does not fall within the scope of scrap control in this clause. So they're making sure to highlight the difference between a non-conforming product that is dispositioned for scrap versus excess material that goes into your scrap bin. If the product is non-conforming to product requirements, that's when the scrap provisions of Clause 8.7 will be acceptable. That's when you have to mark it conspicuously and permanently or positively control it until physically rendered unusable. It's not that every piece of excess material needs to be handled that way. It's when a piece of non-conforming product that's not meeting requirement and is determined to be scrap needs to be dealt with that way. So as it says here, once that material is dispositioned as scrap, then it would need to be marked or positively controlled until it could be rendered unusable. Okay, so then let's talk about corrective action, which is intent 2 of the standard. And the intent of this clause is to ensure your organization manages nonconformities and implements corrective actions appropriately. So when a nonconformity occurs, and this could be from an identified nonconforming output or from a complaint, from a problem rising from an external provider or from audit results, then the organization must take action to investigate what has gone wrong, correct it, and then avoid similar issues from recurring. Okay, so here's where the clause is in the actual standard. It's in 10.2, and it begins with when a nonconformity occurs, including any arising from complaints, the organization shall A, react to the nonconformity and, as applicable, take action to control and correct it, and 2, deal with the consequences. Then B, evaluate the need for action to eliminate the causes of the nonconformity in order that it does not recur or occur elsewhere by 1, reviewing and analyzing the nonconformity, 2, determining the causes of the nonconformity, including as applicable those related to human factors, and 3, determining if similar nonconformities exist or could potentially occur. So once you identify that nonconformity and you identify that there is further need for action, at that point you want to analyze the nonconformity, determine what that root cause is, and then, as C says, implement any action needed. D, review the effectiveness of any corrective action taken. So once you've implemented that corrective action to address that root cause, you must then review that action for effectiveness. You know, did this action actually effectively take care of the problem or eliminate the root cause? Then it says E, update risks and opportunities determined during planning, if necessary. F, make changes to the quality management system, if necessary. G, flow down corrective action requirements to an external provider when it is determined that the external provider is responsible for the nonconformity. And H, take specific actions when timely and effective corrective actions are not achieved. It also notes that corrective actions shall be appropriate to the effects of the nonconformities encountered. And then here is where our procedural requirement comes in. It says the organization shall maintain documented information that defines the nonconformity and corrective action management processes. So this goes to say that what we just discussed in 10.2.1, A through H, should be included in your corrective action procedure. And then there's also the requirement for records of the corrective action process in 10.2.2. It says the organization shall retain document information as evidence of A, the nature of the nonconformities and any subsequent actions taken, and B, the results of any corrective action. So again, zoning in on what actual documentation is required, as discussed, we need to have that procedure that defines your process for nonconformity and corrective action, addressing all those items in 10.2.1. It must be maintained as document information. Typically, we see this in the form of the procedure, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, as long as it describes all those items in 10.2.1. And then you must also keep records as evidence of the corrective actions. They have to describe the nature of the nonconformities, aka what was the nonconforming condition, what happened here, what was the issue, also the subsequent actions taken, meaning it has to record your correction, your containment, your root cause analysis, and your corrective action. All that needs to be captured in your corrective action record, as well as the results of any corrective action. So this is where you determine if the corrective action was effective. Was it ineffective? How did you determine this? Is there additional action needed? Did you need to update risks? So everything in 10.2.2 needs to be recorded in some way. We typically see this captured on a corrective action form. Okay, and then we have a couple of clarifications again from the IAQG that were submitted as frequently asked questions. The first question was, some are interpreting this requirement that we are required to determine causes for every nonconformity we encounter, no matter how insignificant. 9100-2009 allowed us to define our requirements on when we would determine causes in our procedure. Realistically, I don't believe that any organization has the resources to determine causes for every nonconformity. So this question is asking, does this mean now that we have to follow the corrective action process for every single nonconformity, every time someone drops a part, every time something's machined incorrectly? And the answer to this is, Clause 10.2.1b starts with evaluate the need for action. So the first action is to determine if there is a need for action. And if so, then the following actions in Clause 10.2.1b would be required, including the root cause analysis and corrective action. It's up to the organization to establish criteria for when taking corrective actions are appropriate to the effects of the nonconformities encountered. They note here that it is not wise to expend significant resources for isolated low-cost nonconformities. So in sum, when your organization encounters a nonconformity, you correct it, and then you determine based on your defined process if further action is needed. At that point, you would follow the actions in 10.2.1b through H. Okay, and one last clarification here. This question is related to the update risks and opportunities portion of 10.2.1, which is in subclause E. They're asking if, does this need to be performed for every corrective action? Do we need to update risks and opportunities for every corrective action? And the answer here is, the organization determines when to update risks and opportunities based upon corrective actions. This is the risk feedback loop where a possible escape from the risk process has occurred, and the organization determines if inclusion to risk and opportunity planning is required. So this goes back to the portion that Amanda just discussed. And in their answer here, they're not saying that every single corrective action needs to result in risks being updated, but you do have to have a process for determining when those risks and opportunities need to be updated based on those corrective actions. So again, it's up to the organization. Okay, so we got all this information on the control of non-conforming outputs process and the corrective action process. What's the difference of these two in a real life example? How do these two operate differently? How does this get recorded in an actual example that could take place? So let's take a look at this example here. Here's a scenario where a machinist accidentally drops a part, let's say part number 1234, while transporting that finished part to the quality control area, QC, for inspection. So once that part gets there, QC determines that the part did get damaged and is no longer conforming as a result of being dropped. So then QC identifies that part, they put a red tag on it that says non-conforming on it, and they place it, they segregate it in a bin for non-conforming parts. So then at that point, QC will fill out a form for the non-conforming part, documenting the issue and authorizing rework to be completed by the machinist to bring the part back into conformance. The specific person who authorized this signs their initials in the back of the form. So they're recording who actually had the who made the disposition decision on that form as well, along with describing what happened, noting what the disposition was, and they also note that no concessions were needed on that form. So at that point, the QC personnel who signed it is listed in the Control of Non-Conforming Outputs procedure as someone who has been approved to this disposition NC parts. So in this organization, they made sure in the procedure to specify that this specific QC person has the authority to disposition parts. So here we see kind of the Control of Non-Conforming Outputs process in action and how it can be compliant with 8.7. So next, let's take this a little further, and let's say that this same organization requires all of these non-conforming output forms to be submitted to the quality manager. So after the QC personnel had filled out that non-conforming outputs form, he'll submit it, he or she will submit it to the quality manager. At that point, the quality manager will review the form to determine if additional action is needed. In this organization, the quality manager tracks the non-conforming outputs to see if there are any trends. And for this scenario, the quality manager does see that in the last few months, there have been several issues with parts being dropped. And due to this, he determines that corrective action is necessary and initiates a corrective action form. So what information would need to be recorded on that form? Okay, so this is sort of an example of what that quality manager would want to include when filling out a corrective action form. In this scenario, they've included the statement of nonconformity, which describes the issue here, that the process for transporting parts to QC for inspection is not currently effective. We've seen trends of parts being dropped. There's something wrong with the process of transporting these parts to QC. The objective evidence here is that a machinist dropped part number 1234 when bringing the part to QC. Containment was not needed in this situation, but the correction recorded notes that the dropped non-conforming part, part number 1234, was reworked and brought back into conformance. Then we have the root cause here, which they noted as, by having employees transport parts by hand, the process is susceptible to human error. This can be addressed by utilizing carts, but there are currently no formal provisions for this. And as you can see here, this root cause did consider human factors when determining the root cause of the issue. So then they implemented their corrective action, and they noted it here on their form. The corrective action was purchased carts for the purpose of transporting parts. Applicable employees underwent training on the new process for transporting parts to QC and back. Training records attached. The work instruction was also revised to include a clause stating that parts must be transported via cart. Revised work instruction attached. So we see that they went ahead and purchased some carts. They updated their work instruction. They trained their employees. And then once all of this was implemented, they noted their what they did to verify the effectiveness of this implemented corrective action. They note here, implemented the cart system on October 1st. Then on October 31st, no recurrences of dropped parts have been reported or observed. Interviewed employees, it reported that the process is effective. And at this point, corrective action has been verified and closed. They determined that they did not need to update risks here, but they did have a portion on their form where they would indicate that if so. So This is an example here of the corrective action process in action in compliance with 10.2. In this example, there was a non-conforming output that served as the input for the corrective action process. And so this is sort of a summary of what a corrective action record could look like in order to capture all those things that are required to be recorded for the corrective action process. Of course, other inputs for the corrective action process can include customer complaints, audit findings, employee identified problems or external provider issues, or performance data. Okay, so in summary, the control of non-conforming outputs process and the corrective action process are related, but it is important that each process is fully realized in your QMS. So you want to make sure that you are addressing each one of them completely, even if you do choose to kind of combine them in a procedure. As discussed, both 8.7 and 10.2 require a procedure or other means of document information. You can utilize a single document to address both clauses if you'd like, but you must ensure that all aspects are defined and documented. A robust control of non-conforming outputs process and corrective action process will lead to a continually improving and effective quality management system. So any questions on this? If you do, please feel free to type those into the question box and we'll take a look at them. Oh, it looks like we do have a question here. Is there a specific root cause analysis technique that has to be used? And I would say the answer to this is no, there's not a specific prescribed root cause analysis technique that you have to use. There are several that you can use, such as the five whys technique, a fishbone technique. The important thing is that you're getting to the root cause of the problem, that you're not just getting a surface level cause there, that you're really looking into it as thoroughly as you can and eliminating the cause then with corrective action. Is there anything you want to add to that, Amanda?
No, I would agree completely.
Okay.
I see one that says, is the person with authorization to disposition a part or product the same as an inspector? I think that it just depends on what your procedure says. Who are those people that are allowed to disposition a part? You may have granted inspectors that permission. However, you may also not have, and therefore the inspector would inspect it and then take it to the person with the authority to disposition it. So it's really based on your own procedure and who you have designated as that authority. Would you agree, Kim?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, we also have a question asking, what are some examples of non-conforming services documentation? So let me think here. So let's see, a non-conforming service, let's say you're performing a heat treat service and you don't actually apply the heat treating method that was prescribed by the customer, or if you're doing a non-destructive testing service or something like that that's not meeting the customer requirements. That might be an example of a non-conforming service. Is there any other examples you can think of, Amanda?
I think it could also apply to AS9120, so any kind of distribution. If you have it's a 9120 client, it's for distribution, and they put together a process of possibly, how they're sending the items out, how they're packaging them, that kind of thing, that could be an issue. A service that could be non-conforming.
Okay.
So I see a question. It says, what is the process if we receive non-conforming products from our suppliers? So again, that goes back to how you're going to handle it. Obviously, I would believe that you would inform the supplier that there is non-conforming product. You may send it back to the supplier. You may scrap it. That would be a discussion that you would need to have with your supplier. And that would go for non-conforming. Now, let's say you've got a counterfeit part from the supplier. We do not send counterfeit parts back to the supplier. But non-conforming, you can talk to them about it, see if there's any way to use it, get a disposition for that of any kind. Otherwise, you can send it back.
Okay. And we have a question here. Would job descriptions be the most efficient way to cover who is authorized to disposition non-conforming product? And I suppose that could be a way to cover that. You know, 8.7 does say that you need to not only define who has the responsibility and authority, but then define the process for it. So you want to make sure that you're also covering the process for getting someone able to have the responsibility and authority to make those decisions. So that might be able to, you might be able to capture that in your job description, but again, you want to make sure that you're addressing all of 8.7 in some way, whether it's in your procedure and some other documented, maintained document information. Anything else you want to add there, or if you agree there, Amanda?
No, I agree.
Okay.
When identifying operational risk, 8.1.1, how broad is the scope when identifying risk? So I would say any, when you're sitting down and you're trying to identify the risk or you come across the risk, I would say that it's any kind of risk that you come across, and then you just have to determine what would be done, if anything needs to be done, a proportional reaction to the risk or action that you would do. It may be a risk that you're going to accept because you want to take on the opportunity. So I would say any kind of risk that you would come across. So I would, you know, for 8.1.1, I would be as broad as anything that pops up that could cause the product or the service to be either non-conforming or on-time delivery could be late. You may not be able to actually create the part. So anything that would be included for that could affect the part or the service.
Okay, I see a question here. I thought you could not rework parts without design or customer review. In this example, QC signed off on the rework. So let's see here. In 8.7, it says dispositions of use as is or repair for the acceptance of non-conforming products should only be implemented once you have that authorization. So I believe there's a slight difference between rework and repair. Repair is, you know, taking an action on non-conforming product to make it conform to requirements. And unlike rework, repair can affect or change parts of the non-conforming product. So there's a little more to repair rather than rework. And I think that's the distinction there in 8.7. Would you agree there, Amanda?
Yep, I absolutely would agree with that. So it says, what examples are there for obtaining customer approval for use as is MRB disposition? So I may not understand the question exactly, but what are examples of MRB dispositions? They could either disposition it to use as is, they could disposition it for rework, they could disposition it for, scrap. So if you're going back to your customer for approval from the MRB disposition, those are the types of some examples of what they made, how they may disposition that non-conforming part. Is that what you took from the question, Kim?
Yes. Yep. That's what I was thinking too. Okay, and I think we had a couple questions on concessions obtained and what that means. And so this is referring to when you can, I believe this is referring to when you can use as is or repair. Once you get approval from the representative of the organization responsible for design, or by having persons delegated authority from the design organization and after authorization by the customer if the non-conformity results in a departure from contract requirements. Anything you want to add to that, Amanda? Is that what you were getting from that question too?
Yep. Any kind of concession that you receive on what to do with that non-conforming part. Yep. Let's see here. So it says FEMA can work well for operational risk management. Is there some form or tool that can be used for organizational risk management? You could possibly use a FEMA also for an organizational risk management. It's just not conventional, correct? But I really don't know of any specific forms that you can use. Lots of companies have lots of different forms they would use. They could create their own form. I'm sure you could go online and look up for a blank form that you could use, but it's basically anything that you're going to use. A lot of them will use an Excel so that they could put what the risk is if they've determined, you know, how high the risk is, what's the impact or severity that it's going to have on your organization. Are you going to accept that risk? Are you going to do some sort of mitigation to get rid of that risk? So a lot of different either forms or Excel, or you can create your own form. I don't know of any one specific sort of form that's better than another that you could use for the organizational risk management.
Okay, and there's a question here. Is the person with authorization to disposition a part or product the same as an inspector? It could be. Again, that's up to you and your organization to define who has the responsibility and authority for dispositioning non-conforming parts.
Okay, I do not necessarily see any additional questions coming through. So please feel free if you have any. I'm just going to sum up really quick. Thank you for joining us on our webinar today. I wanted to make sure that I restated that the webinar slides will be on the PGR website for you, and that the webinar recording will be on the PGR YouTube channel. And there should be a link to that on our PGR website, or you can just go to YouTube and search for PJR. So I still don't see any additional questions. So I hope that this was informational for you folks, and I hope that you enjoyed it. If you have any other questions, please feel free to reach out to PGR and we can help you with that. Otherwise, thank you again for coming, and we hope that you have a fantastic day.